Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Moby began his musical career in earnest, in poverty, and in an abandoned factory 1 mile south of the Stamford, Connecticut train station. But he heard music everywhere. In the gunshots after sundown, the gospel pumping out of the Jamaican church across the street, from the passing cars playing Public Enemy at window-rattling levels, and from the roosters kept in backyards near the industrial wasteland where he lived. Years later, Moby's music was everywhere. His 1999 mega-hit album, Play, went platinum in more than 20 countries, and he was called one of the most important electronic dance music artists of all time.
I've seen so much in so many places, so many heartaches, so many faces, so many dirty things you couldn't even believe. I would stand in line for this.
The story of how he got there, through drug and alcohol addiction and wrestling with doubts about his deeply felt Christianity and his relationship with God, that is the story Moby tells in his new memoir, Porcelain. Moby came into our studios to talk about his book and his early life, but something interesting happened before we started talking. I asked him which one of his tracks he thought would best get the conversation going, and he surprised us. He said, none of them. Instead, he wanted to start with something else, the 1975 country and pop novelty song Convoy by C.W. McCall.
So, this was the first 7-inch single I ever bought. In 1974 or 1975, I was living in Stratford, Connecticut, and my friend Ron Little found a $5 bill. And it was honestly the most exciting thing that had ever happened in either one of our lives. Like, we'd never even seen $5. And he gave me a dollar. And with that dollar, I bought the 7-inch of Convoy by C.W. McCall, which was this weird country-western song about CB radios.
It was the dark of the moon on the 6th of June in a Kenworth pulling logs. Cab over Pete with a reefer on and a Jimmy hauling hogs. We is heading for Bear on I-10 about a mile out of Shaky Town. I says, Pigpen, this here's a rubber duck and I'm about to put the hammer down.
I listened to it 40 times in a row. Like, I kept picking up the needle and putting it down, picking up the needle and putting it down, like compulsively, obsessively listening to this song.
We got a great big convoy rocking through the night. Yeah, we got a great big convoy. Ain't she a beautiful sight?
Why were you so compulsive about that song? What were you hearing in it?
Every time I heard music when I was growing up, let's say from like age 2 until age 10, I just couldn't believe that something that existed in the immaterial realm would transform the environment in which it was being heard and which would completely affect me emotionally. Like, it just seemed like this utterly baffling alchemical magic.
How important was it to you as that young boy in Connecticut who, you know, rarely if ever had seen $5 to have music allow that transformation outside of your what your reality was?
It was, for me, profoundly important because I hated my reality. I grew up very poor in a very affluent town, Darien, Connecticut, and I was on food stamps and welfare till I was 18. And when I was growing up, I loved anything that took me out of that.
You know, in the book Porcelain, you write very honestly and touchingly about that time growing up. I mean, the book opens with a scene of you and your mom at a laundromat, and at times neighbors paid her to do their laundry. And you sort of took shelter in the car because it was raining and it was depressing, and you just needed to escape that moment, and how you were listening to the radio and just jumping between channels because no music was off limits. I mean, were you that? There's a musical way in which you, it seemed to me as if you were hearing the world. I mean, has that Is that an accurate interpretation?
I think it's almost, not to sound too grad student-y, but like a hypersomatic sensitivity. If your formative years happen in a safe, predictable environment, you don't need to develop hypersensitivity. You trust that the world and your family has your back. But I grew up in a very unstable environment. And so as a result, I think some deep atavistic part of my brain developed a hypersensitivity towards everything, towards light, towards furniture, towards temperature, towards everything.
Well, I'm going to just want to move forward in time a little bit, away from your formative years in Connecticut to 1995 and the album Everything Is Wrong, because there's a particular track that you write about how you wrote it so beautifully in Porcelain, the memoir, and that track is God Moving Over the Face of the Waters. So let's listen.
I had a long period as a very serious Christian, and now, just as a way of sort of being an apologist for my own weird faith, like, I am a Taoist, quantum mechanics loving, Sufi, aspiring Jew, Hindu, whatever. I'm an everything. Like, I don't feel the need to treat spirituality like a sports team.
Now, in the book, you write about how when you were writing this, composing this piece of music, that, I mean, it brought you to tears.
Mm-hmm. So there's some language in the beginning of the Bible, and they said, you know, the earth was without form and void, and God moved over the face of the waters. So when I was writing this piece of music, I had this vision of the Spirit of God, whoever, whatever that might be, moving over the earth and just seeing this tabula rasa, this blank slate of a planet, but with foresight and prescience and omniscience, seeing what was going to happen. All of the suffering, but all of the joy.
There's a sort of continuing subcurrent in the book that I, at least it felt like to me, that you'd always been from a young age sort of either attracted to or drawn to this sort of monastic sensibility, because I was thinking about how you were living in an abandoned warehouse for a time.
Mm-hmm.
In Connecticut. And actually, I mean, you write about it very lovingly, that you adored living there.
I loved my abandoned warehouse.
In a 100-square-foot little patch of the warehouse.
Yeah, I didn't have a bathroom. I didn't have running water. And I was making around $3,000 a year. But I loved my little corner of the abandoned warehouse. Like, I was in this factory. I had a community of friends. I was making music with my Casio keyboard and my cheap old cassette recorder. And I was very happy. I just didn't know it at the time.
Yeah.
You know, because I assumed, oh, I'll be happy when I move to New York. I'll be happy when I get a record deal. I'll be happy when I have commercial success. And all those things are fine, but none of them actually deliver happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because rich people are miserable. You know, I had this experience a few years ago. I was at a billionaire's birthday party in New York, and he had rented the Hammerstein Ballroom, which holds about 4,000 people. And he only had 100 people there, which was weird, 100 people in a venue that held 4,000. And he hired Earth, Wind & Fire to play. And Michael Bloomberg was there, and Trump was there, and all the New York billionaires were there. I got invited. I don't even know how I got invited. And Earth, Wind & Fire were playing, and Trump was dancing, Bloomberg was dancing, but they were joyless, clearly like just uptight and joyless. And I looked over at the kitchen staff who were dancing and having the time of their lives.
Huh.
And I simply thought, like, how have we all gotten this so wrong that everyone aspires to be the billionaire, but the billionaires are miserable?
Well, I'm speaking with Moby. His new memoir is called Porcelain, and it chronicles his life most detailed way through the 90s, just before the release of his mega hit, play. We've got a track here that I think you released not long after moving to New York. It's called Rock the House, that you recorded under the pseudonym Brainstorm. Do I have that right in terms of the date?
I think that sounds right.
Okay, so let's listen. Rock the house, rock, rock the house, rock the house, rock the house. So tell us a little bit about your early days in New York.
So in the mid-80s, I started getting more and more exposed to dance music and black music and Latino music. And I found myself as a straight white guy from Connecticut DJing and hanging out in predominantly African-American Latino gay clubs and falling in love with that culture and feeling so honored to be allowed into that world. And it was just a wonderful time because the dance culture then was really, and I kind of hate to use this word, but it was truly underground, meaning there were mores and sounds and modes of dress and everything that only existed in this little world in Lower Manhattan.
Yeah.
You know, you'd have huge hit records that only were huge hit records in like a 10-block radius.
Mm. Did you ever feel, though, at times that the places where your music was allowed to flower and grow the way it did, were those places and what was happening in them were in conflict with your Christianity? Because you were getting DJ jobs off your other DJ jobs. You were getting you know, hooked up with other people, and you got hired to work in what was basically like a sex loft.
Yeah.
And there are mattresses everywhere, and people are having sex. I mean, did you ever feel conflicted that these were the places that your music was allowed to flourish?
You know, I think that somehow at that time, I was really good at compartmentalizing. You know, so by day, I was this serious Christian, but then at night, I would DJ anywhere. And it didn't seem like a conflict to me. I can see why it would have seemed like a conflict to other people, but I think I had some sort of subjective, innate idea that ethics only apply to actions that potentially hurt other things or other people. You know, so like walking into a sex club, if it's all volitional, if people are there, you know, no one's there being coerced to do anything, but a bunch of like sad Department of Motor Vehicle employees having naked sex on like soiled mattresses, like that just seemed depressing, not necessarily unethical.
Hmm. We should probably get some more music back into this conversation here. So let's jump to 1991, I believe. And this is, again, kind of a track from your earlier days in New York. This is Go, Woodtick Mix, that you made, I believe, after watching an episode of Twin Peaks. So let's listen.
This song, Go, to put it in perspective, I had a single before Go came out called Mobility, and I think we sold 2,000 copies of Mobility, which to me was a huge success. Then Go came out, and it became a top 10 record in Europe. And I was on Top of the Pops with New Order and Phil Collins, and I remember flying to England and looking at a newspaper where they had a singles chart. And my little song that I'd recorded in my bedroom, essentially, was in between Phil Collins and Michael Jackson. And I just thought, what in the world has happened here? Like, this is not how it's supposed to be. I'm supposed to be a weird, obscure musician from New England who no one pays attention to. Like, that's the natural order of things. Like, it was almost like a disturbance in the force that led me to have anything even resembling a career.
Hmm. Well, since we are here in Boston, I do want to talk a little bit about Mission of Burma because you covered one of their great songs. And here's the Mission of Burma version of their own song that you covered. Here it is.
Fast forward 15 years. It's 1996. I'm known as like a techno icon, and I say that in air quotes. The entire world is ready for the techno musicians to make their platinum records, and the Prodigy come out and they make their platinum record, and Fatboy Slim makes his platinum techno record, and the Chemical Brothers make their platinum techno record, and I make a dark, difficult, noisy punk rock record called Animal Rights that sells nothing and is pretty much universally reviled. But I did a cover of the Mission of Burma song. That's when I reached for my revolver. Because there was such a desperate emotional resignation and beauty to that song. The spirit passes by this way. One of the goals of art is to sort of say, this is my experience of being, you know, at times joyful, at times sad, but always vulnerable in this weird human form.
I wanted to close with a question that links us back to where we started. Your story about being a young 8 and 9 year old boy in Connecticut, because you kind of end with that thought in the book. You talk about how an ex-girlfriend of yours had told you that before the two of you broke up, she said to you that you were like a scared, beaten dog who lived under a porch, and that you agreed. That you wanted to finally move out from under the porch and live in the daylight, but couldn't, and that if you came out from under the porch and ran around in the light, you worried that, quote, I would be seen for who I really was, the inadequate 8-year-old boy with food stamps in his pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been able to fully come out into the light?
Oh, absolutely not. I think that on an almost like archetypal level, like, who you are during your formative years, to some extent, you are for your entire life. I have this weird, I call it the rolled up carpet theory of personality. Like, you've bought rolled up carpets before, right?
Yeah.
So you take it home, you put it on the floor, and it just wants to stay as a rolled up carpet. Because for a long time, that's all it's been, a rolled up carpet in a warehouse somewhere. And it made a lot of sense for it to stay as a rolled up carpet. It takes a lot of effort to turn it into a regular carpet lying flat on the floor. Like weeks of like putting books and weights on the corners to like force it to go flat. And so undoing these sort of ingrained innate personal archetypes from our developmental years, from the formative years, takes a lot of effort. But to an extent, we are always the rolled up carpet in the warehouse, you know. So part of it's like changing what you can and accepting the rest.
Ooh, Lordy, my trouble so hard. Ooh, Lordy, my trouble so hard.
Well, the new memoir is called Porcelain. It's Moby's story of his own life from a young boy to his early years in New York City, all the way up to what inspired the release of Play. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing the story with us and for talking with me. This has been an absolute pleasure. And in the spirit of what you talked about, it's made me very happy.
Oh, well, thanks. Thank you very much.
And that's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.